Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Here we are on a Monday. It's the first Monday in April. You realize that, RT? This is the first Monday in April.
Things are just moving so quickly in 2014. I'm having a hard time keeping track.
Of course, yes, unless you have remembered the winter that never seemed to go away. But there is hope this week, I think. Is there not? All across the Upper Midwest, our Faith Radio Network.
Decidedly people. Pleasing yes. Numbers on the forecast, yes.
We're going to go for that. So we could talk forecasting because our guest knows all about forecasting.
He does.
Actually, it's marriage forecasting, but it's kind of like the weather. It can turn on you in a minute. No, that's okay. Let me.
Did you have that prepared?
No.
That was
you
good.
You wouldn't know about that, Ryan. So I'm Neil Stavem. That's Ryan Thomas. Grace is at the phones, and we're looking forward to welcoming back Tim Muehlhoff back to the broadcast on Connecting Faith. Tim is a professor of communication at Biola University in La Mirada, California, where it's another lovely day. He teaches classes in family communication, interpersonal communication, and gender. He's authored the book we referenced, Marriage Forecasting, Changing the Climate of Your Relationship, One Conversation at a Time. He's also co-authored a couple books, The God Conversation, Using Stories and Illustrations to Explain Your Faith, and Authentic Communication, Christian Speech, Engaging Culture. And he and his wife, Noreen, are frequent speakers at the Family Life Marriage Conferences. So maybe if you've been to one of those, and I hope that you have, you probably had an opportunity to hear Tim. I want to talk about his new book today, because it certainly will be appropriate for the day in which we live. It's called I Beg to Differ, Navigating Difficult Conversations with Truth and Love. So are you ready, Ryan, so we can have a difficult conversation?
I want to learn.
Okay. Welcome, Tim, to Connecting Faith.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
and you don't have to actually give a forecast because you've had actually a little rain and inclement weather in Southern California this winter as well, right?
Well, and earthquakes.
Yeah.
Don't forget the earthquakes.
Oh, sure. Okay. All right. You got us beat. Okay. Yeah, we had cold and snow, but it's tough to top earthquakes. Let's talk about this new book from InterVarsity, because we do live in a pretty polarized society, it seems like, and it's easy to find people who disagree with us. And I guess the question is, can we disagree without being disagreeable? And I'm wanting to, was this a result of maybe some of the work that you've been doing in marriage, dealing with marriage conflict, that, or is it just seeing sort of trends in society? So, we need to actually have a serious conversation about conversation.
Well, I think it certainly affects our marriages, without a doubt. But I'm looking at the bigger picture, which is what Deborah Tannen calls the argument culture, that we approach everything as though it's this verbal slugfest. And all you have to do to confirm that is turn on CNN, MSN, Fox News, and watch people try to talk about the most important things you can imagine, like traditional marriage, immigration, the budget, climate, the warming of the climate, and you get people who don't try to find common ground with each other, but really attack each other and try to misquote each other to use it to their advantage. So the argument culture today, I think, has trickled down into our families, our churches, our marriages, and our corporations.
So are we actually more disagreeable today, or have we just forgotten how to engage in dialogue? I mean, is it just a matter of Emily Post could, review some of those lessons?
Well, I think, certainly people are disagreeable. I mean, when somebody was challenging Abraham Lincoln, he would publicly call him a baboon. So it's not that we have a corner on the market today of being uncivil with each other. I think part of the problem, Neil, is we're doing more talking than ever before in the history of humanity, and the mere presence of these words, I think, is causing us to take words for granted, the power of them. For example, in the book, I mentioned that there are 200 million tweets happening per day, which is 2,315 per second. And if Facebook were its own country, it'd be the second largest country in the world, only lagging behind China and India. So we are talking more than ever before today, but we're not learning how to talk with nuance, or we're not learning how to talk about really delicate issues in a way that's productive. We're basically doing uncivil monologues instead of having productive dialogue.
Sounds a lot like this show. No, that's not true. No, today we'll break the mold on that. But, you know, it was interesting as I was looking at the book. And by the way, we've got, seven copies to give away. Thanks to Tim and InterVarsity for that. Love to have you sign up for one. If you'd like to join the conversation, let me just give the phone number out right now. It's 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. Who couldn't benefit from some important writing on the book, I Beg to Differ, Navigating Difficult Conversations with Truth and Love. Tim, one of the things I was interested in just looking at right at the beginning and really throughout the book, how much the Bible has to say about speech and conversation, the power of words. I guess it just sort of surprised me to see it so clearly. Let's talk about maybe some key biblical passages which need to inform our understanding of conversation.
Well, I would say without a doubt, the book of Proverbs you could go to, and boy, do we ever need to read the book of Proverbs today to understand how to craft difficult conversations. You know, the book of Proverbs says that reckless words are like a sword that has been pierced into a person's body. Another proverb says that a scorching fire can be compared to a person's speech, that a person's speech can divide an entire city, and that it's powerful enough to actually break a bone if spoken in the wrong way. And of course, the most powerful passage is when the proverbs say that life and death are in the power of the tongue. And that's why Jesus in the New Testament, he comes out and he says, listen, I'm telling you right now, every careless word you say, I'm telling you, you'll be held accountable for every single one of those words. And the reason he was so concerned about words is because he said that I can tell your heart based on the words that you use. Cicero, an ancient Roman philosopher, had a saying, as the speech, so the life. And I think Christ took that very seriously, that you'll be held accountable for all of our words that we speak.
And, of course, James, we know those familiar words about, you know, the power of the tongue to start a big fire.
Yeah, and, you know, living in Southern California, that analogy is not lost on us here, because we get wildfires all the time. And these wildfires really are started by one little spark from a cigarette, from a firecracker, or something like that. So James is saying, I want you to look at a hillside that has been burned away, and I want you to imagine that your language is exactly like that. So the Apostle Paul says, I want you to get rid of all unwholesome communication. And that word unwholesome in the Greek, that refers to rotted fruit, rotted meat. So I'm teaching this one class right now, and the first assignment they had was I gave every single one of them, 35 students, a banana, and they weren't allowed to eat the banana. They had to watch it rot all semester and then journal on how their speech can be like this rotted fruit and how God, we look at the banana now, it's horrible. You have to wear hazmat suits just to handle this banana because it's gotten so rotted. Well, that's how God views unwholesome communication. He said it's like rotted meat in front of my eyes. And so as Christians, we need to take that very seriously, that God is not going to put up with unwholesome communication happening.
Yes, I don't think I'd miss having to do that assignment, just as a little side note.
Well, you know, my son found the banana, my middle son, and he was so disgusted by it, he threw it away.
Oh.
And that's exactly what the Apostle Paul says to do, by the way. He says, I want you to get rid of this. I want you to put it away from you. These kind of hurtful, rotted words that demean people. And he even uses the phrase, stop devouring each other with your language.
Do we realize that? I mean, do we realize that we're devouring others? I mean, I'm wondering if you know, we're talking about navigating difficult conversations. Are we halfway into a conversation, or it's over before we realize that, you know, we've created a difficulty or added to the problem, or we've had unwholesome talk?
Well, boy, that's a hard question. I would say the problem with social media today, Neil, is that I don't see the effect of my communication per se. It'd be different if you and I were sitting having coffee at Starbucks and I said something and I got a reaction from you right away and it was like, oh, geez, I think I overstepped my bounds or I said something and now Neil's upset. The problem with social media is I never see the full impact of my communication on individuals. So I could be deeply hurting individuals and not really know it. So the problem with social media is we don't think what this tweet is going to do, and we don't necessarily think about that comment we posted on an article that made us angry. We don't see the full effect of it, and I think that's caused us to become very careless with our words. And I would also say that sometimes even in face-to-face conversations, I don't necessarily know that what I said just hurt you. The people in my class, my students, will sometimes write a paper on their self-image. Like, how did you come to believe the things that are true about you? And in my class, I had 5 women who had eating disorders because their dads joked about their body image. They just made this careless joke, or they were just kidding, but these girls took it seriously, and it resulted in them going into eating disorders. Now, I'm sure the dads would be horrified that their comment was received this way. So we need to practice what we call perception checking, which means after a conversation, it's really good to say to a person, hey, listen, what did you just hear me say right now? And let that person respond. And then we might have to correct some of the things we just said.
Talking today about the importance of communication from a God-centered perspective, the new book is called I Beg to Differ, Navigating Difficult Conversations with Truth and Love, and it's written by Tim Muehlhoff. Tim is a professor of communication at Biola University, and he's authored several books, including Marriage Forecasting, Changing the Culture, the Climate of Your Relationship, One Conversation at a Time. And he's also written The God Conversation, Using Stories and Illustrations to Explain Your Faith. So we're going to talk about how do we handle some of those difficult conversations, whether it relates to marriage and family, or maybe it's sharing faith, or it's dealing with difficulties in the workplace. We'll get into some of the important steps as a 4-part communication strategy. We'll deal with that and more coming up in just a moment with Tim. Invite you to join the conversation as well. We do have some copies of the book to give away, and love to hear your thoughts. If you have a question or an experience, you're welcome to join us at 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. We'll continue in a minute.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Are you new to the station? Well, welcome. It's great to have you tuning in. We have a new listener packet that's designed for friends just like you. It tells you a little bit about the station, who we are, why we exist, and what we're hoping to accomplish in the Upper Midwest. It's yours free for the asking at myfaithradio.com. Check it out. It's myfaithradio.com. It's the new listener packet. Request yours today.
The future you long for is just a few steps away. A future where you grow in your career, invest in others, and impact the world.
The first step is Thursday, April 17th at 6 p.m. Information night at University of Northwestern, St. Paul, will give you a closer look at what you can gain through graduate and adult undergrad programs. You'll meet professors, learn about degrees, and visit with current students. Reserve your place at unwsp.edu.
University of Northwestern, St. Paul. Learn, lead, invest, impact.
Talk to one another, we've got to learn to talk it out. We've got to know exactly what the other's about. But when we talk to one another, just like the Father above, oh, we've got to learn to say it, just like Jesus always said it, we all need.
about having difficult or navigating difficult conversations with truth and love. That's the subtitle of the new book from Tim Muehlhoff. It's called I Beg to Differ. It's just new out from InterVarsity Press. Tim's professor of communication at Biola University and has written several books. And we're talking about how do we move from contentious debate to constructive dialogue. And we've got some copies of the book to give away. We'd love to have you join the conversation, or at least sign up for a book, and we'll do a drawing for that, 877-93-FAITH. Or if you want to drop us a note using the email link on our website, you go to myfaithradio.com and then click on Connecting Faith. And Tim, we just mentioned a little bit ago about maybe perception checking, that you talk in the book about the second-order reality in our conversations. Explain a little bit more about that and why we have to be so aware of that.
Yeah, as communication scholars, we break all of reality up into what we call first and second order realities. So a first order reality would be something that is undeniably true. Like, for instance, when Barack Obama ran to be president his first time, he did not wear a lapel pin of the American flag. So that's a first order reality. It's undeniable he's not wearing the American flag on his lapel. But what does that mean is what we call a second-order reality. So his opponents quickly said that he was not patriotic. They looked at the absence of the lapel pin, and they said, okay, this man is not in favor of patriotism. And we do that all the time. Like, we could be having family dinner, and one of my kids just quickly sends off a text with his phone. And now that's a first-order reality. It's undeniable he sent a text. But the second order reality is I might say, hey, he's not interested in family dinner, he's bored, he's being disobedient because he sent off a text. So that's my second order interpretation, and we do this all the time. Your spouse is late for dinner, and it's obviously true he or she was late, but what does that mean? And we might say, oh, see, they don't care about family time. They don't care about career is more important than family dinner. And so what we have to do is to stop and say, okay, my interpretation of that facial expression you just gave me is this, but I need to check that with a person. So I might say to my son at the dinner table, hey, are you kind of bored with dinner? And he said, oh, no, I'm sorry. My friend just applied for a job, and he was letting me know if he got it. And it's like, oh, okay, that's cool. I mean, that's fine, but I'd prefer you not text at the dinner table. So we need to check these second-order interpretations that we have of people's actions. Otherwise, we're just judging them based on our priorities.
It does seem, though, that in all interaction conversation, I mean, that emotion sort of gets into it. And whether it's, you know, misperception, I mean, there isn't the saying, I mean, our emotions are emotions. I mean, that's whether our feelings are right or wrong, that's the way we feel. So how do we maybe turn down the emotion a little bit on those difficult conversations?
Well, I don't know if it's always wise to turn down the emotion. Some people need to have their emotions turned up. The biggest problem we deal with in conflict is what we call latent conflict, which means I'm mad at you, but I'm not saying anything. I kind of have a slow burn towards you, but I'm not bringing the issue up for whatever reason. And that is disastrous for people who work together or people at a church or family members or spouses, because that simmering anger will really bleed out into the conversation. But some people are like, yeah, but I'm just not going to get into it. For whatever reason, we tried to talk about this, it didn't work, so I'm just not going to deal with it. Well, those people need to have their emotions ramped up a little bit to get motivated to deal with this particular issue. So for some people, it's like, hey, you're approaching this way too calmly in the fact that you're not even addressing the issues that need to be addressed. So they kind of need an emotional kick in the pants to say, hey, you do need to get in here and address these issues with your family because it's killing the family. But the mistake would be to go in without no plan whatsoever of how to construct the conversation. You can't just take a deep breath and start speaking because this issue needs to be addressed. That can cause as much damage as good. And the book of Proverbs says that both death and life are in the power of the tongue.
Well, so speaking of a plan, I know that you've talked about it and lay out a 4-part communication strategy. And maybe just to briefly summarize that now, and then we'll kind of go back and dive into it a little bit more in detail.
Yeah, we have to have some kind of a strategy, Neil. John Gottman, one of the top marriage experts, says the first 2 minutes of that conversation, he calls it the critical startup. That is going to set the tone for the entire conversation, those first 2 minutes. So I've come up with four questions I think we need to ask during the course of the conversation, and we do it in order. So the very first question is, what does this person believe about this issue? It could be politics, it could be sharing Christ, it could be talking about a family's finances, but ask the person, what do you believe about this? The book of Proverbs says, for you to speak without listening, it is both folly and shame to you for doing that, for speaking before listening. The second question is, why do they believe it? Like, why is it so important that we can't be late to anything, right? Find out the history of that person's beliefs or convictions. The third question is, where do we agree with each other? Not where do we disagree, but what are the commonalities that we can focus on? And then the fourth question is, based on everything you've just learned from those first three questions, what's the one thing I should say to this person? Not the five things, not the 10 things, but what's the one thing I should say to that person?
Writing down some notes, a helpful summary. It's available in the book, I Beg to Differ, Navigating Difficult Conversations with Truth and Love. We're going to get to some phone calls here in a moment, but I do want to ask, you know, someone's jokingly described the two parts of a conversation as talking and waiting to talk.
Yeah.
let's talk about the, you know, this pattern that is so prevalent with all of us, really.
Well, here's the problem that I see, and it happens to me all the time. Let's say you have teenage kids. And you're wanting to talk to them about spiritual things, or you're wanting to talk to them about how they dress when they go off to school, or you want to talk to your spouse about finances or sexual intimacy, right? But you're not having the conversation. It just never seems to come up. So in your mind, you're having this conversation over and over and over, and you're actually coming up with a list of things that you'll say once the conversation starts. So then, lo and behold, one day, out of the blue, it shocks you that you and your spouse are actually talking about finances. It came up. So now I jump in to what we call agenda anxiety, which is, okay, I've been waiting for this moment. I might be waiting for this moment for months or years, and so now I'm going to absolutely make sure I say everything I've been thinking about for the last couple months. And so, yeah, so I'm talking, and I don't really care what you think. There are just some things I want to get off my chest about this issue, and I'm afraid I won't get to all the things on my agenda. So I force the conversation to just be about what I think. And as we're doing that, you better believe our spouse is thinking, okay, whoa, I am never bringing this issue up again. Or a teenage daughter saying, I am never talking about how I dress with my mom, because she just went crazy on me with all of this monologue, and none of it was a dialogue.
Yeah, oh, good insight. Let's take a quick question. Aaron is listening in Clear Lake, and Aaron, we've only got about a minute or so, but I'll let you give your question, and then we'll talk about it on the other side of the break.
Sure. Yeah, thank you very much for having this on. Communication, I think, every living soul on the earth could probably benefit from learning more of. The question I have is, you know, if, for example, let's say a coworker or someone, family, blows up and is, you know, and seemingly out of, you know, irrational a bit and disproportioned, and you go through this conflict, how do you continue on without feeling a bit withdrawn spiritually, or just open, closing yourself off to that person?
Yeah, after that experience, where does closeness come, and can you find it again? It's an excellent question, Aaron. Thank you for that. And if you want to, you know, hang on through the break or listen on air, we'll get to that answer here right after the bottom of the hour, and get to more of your questions as well with Tim Muehlhoff. Tim is a communication expert. He's a professor of communication at Biola University. He's authored several books, including The God Conversation, Using Stories and Illustrations to Explain Your Faith, Marriage Forecasting, one of his recent ones, Changing the Climate of Your Relationship One Conversation at a Time. The new one we're referencing is called I Beg to Differ, Navigating Difficult Conversations with Truth and Love. And there's more to come. In just a moment, if you'd like to join us, it's 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. Talking about navigating difficult conversations with truth and love. Sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we have a lot of truth, not a lot of love. Other times, love and no truth. The title of the book is called I Beg to Differ, from communications professor Tim Muehlhoff, and who's been a regular speaker. He and his wife, Noreen, speak at Family Life Marriage Conferences regularly. He's served with Campus Crusade for a number of years. And Dennis Rainey, host of Family Life, says, we're naturally very good at initiating conflict, and we're naturally very bad at resolving conflict, which is, I think, pretty accurate. Now, it's not just in the marriage and interpersonal relationships, but it's, you know, when it comes to sharing our faith or, you know, job issues or whatever it might be. And Aaron had a question for Tim here just before the break about how do we, when a conflict ends, how do we get that closeness back? Is that possible to get that back? Tim, what do you think?
Well, it definitely is possible to get it back. Studies have been done that conflict actually, if handled correctly, can increase a sense of closeness and intimacy between individuals. So the good news is that communication theory would say that relationship can actually become stronger if they carefully handle what has just happened. So if what Aaron said is true, that this guy had a blow-up reaction, then you need to back off, certainly, from talking about that issue. But that doesn't mean you stop talking with that person. Sometimes the mistake we make is when we have a blow-up with a person at work or in a family situation, we avoid that person. And I think what we need to do is pursue that person, but not directly about the issue. So, again, they work together at the same corporation or business, so I would focus on business-related things and seek to compliment that person for his or her skill within the workplace. If my wife and I have a blow-up conversation about finances, I can't just limit our whole relationship to this one disagreement, so I would look to find ways of affirming her in other areas as we seek to build up that communication climate when we're finally going to address that issue. And when we do address the issue, is that's where the two questions come in hand, is one, why does this person believe what he or she does? And then second, where's the common ground that can be found? So I would say to Aaron, when you eventually do talk about this issue, I would want to find out why this person is so passionate about what he's arguing. And second, there's got to be points of agreement when you listen to him that you can point to and to say, hey, when you said this, it really made me think, and I just want you to know you made an impression on me when you said that.
It's interesting that you talk about that ability to affirm greater than the ability to debate. I mean, it seems like we're always looking for, our first reaction is to look for points of disagreement, isn't it?
Well, Neil, I think that's what I was talking about at the beginning of this interview. When you watch the argument culture on primetime television, you see people are not looking for points of agreement. They're brought on the show precisely because they disagree with each other, and that's what the producer wants. He wants this disagreement. And so we seldom see people do nuanced affirming or agreeing with each other. And I challenge my students deeply that the first step ought to be to affirm where you can affirm and agree where you can agree. So one of my assignments at UNC Chapel Hill, at Biola, is my students read the Quran cover to cover in one of my classes. Now, Biola stands for the Biblical Institute of Los Angeles. And so when they read the Quran, but just reading it isn't condoning it. It's reading it. It's finding out what the Quran says. Their first assignment is they have to write a paper all the ways that the Bible and the Quran agree with each other. And again, the Quran would say that Jesus was born of a virgin, that he performed miracles. Quran would say that fasting is important, prayer is important. Now, I'm sure your listeners are thinking of points of disagreement with every single one of those commonalities. But let's not start there. We start with agreement and move towards disagreement whenever possible. And so when your wife sits down with you or a child or a coworker and they say, hey, I have concerns about this, in your mind, if you're creating a bullet list of all the ways I disagree with that person, and that's how you start, is by disagreeing, then you've set up the conversation to be one big disagreement. Because remember what John Gottman said, those first 2 minutes will set the entire conversation. So if you come off defensive, angry, attacking, then that person is going to respond to you in the exact same way, and you're going to have another blow-up conversation.
And one of the other things I thought was interesting, you sort of alluded to, I think, answering Aaron's question, was the importance of small talk, that, you know, it doesn't always have to be about the issue, but just having conversation is valuable, right, just in terms of continuing to build relationship.
Yeah, communication scholars actually have a word for this. We call it phatic communication. Emphatic communication is that big, dramatic conversations that we have with people. But the phatic is just horsing around about simple things. We call it small talk, just talking about the NCAA tournament, talking about weather, for crying out loud, or talking about a project that's happening within the work environment, or asking my wife how other things are going besides, you know, our disagreement about finances. That daily communication, the small talk sets up the big talk. And so if we've closed ourselves off from this person because we had that big dramatic disagreement, then the small talk just doesn't exist anymore, and that makes the disagreement even more pronounced. So as much as possible, I would try to still stay in the small talk. Even though you're dying to talk about the issue, now is not the time to talk about it.
Well, in fact, follow up on that, because there's a part in the book where you're talking about, you know, where we sometimes act like, you know, children in seedlings, and we want to plant and harvest the same day, that we just, you know, we aren't very patient, and maybe it's because there's this verse that we've, you know, had ingrained in our minds, don't let the sun go down in your anger. So, you know, we have to get after it and take care of it right now.
Boy, Neil, that verse, if you take any verse of the New Testament that has probably done more damage because of being misinterpreted, is that verse from Paul saying, don't let the sun go down on your anger. But when I speak at these conferences, I say, okay, don't let the sun go down on your disagreement. Don't let the sun go down on resolving the disagreement. The Apostle Paul's not saying any of that. He's saying, don't let the sun go down on your anger. He's not saying resolve this in a 24-hour period. That would actually do great damage. So imagine what Aaron's question was, right? I had a blow-up with a person at work. Well, Paul's not saying, hey, I'm sorry, man, push through this thing and try to resolve it within 24 hours. He's saying deal with the anger you have towards that person. So I would go to the Lord and say, Lord, I am angry towards my coworker. I'm angry towards my teenage son. I'm angry towards my spouse. And bring it to the Lord and ask the Lord to help you with that powerful emotion of anger. But that's between you and the Lord at that point. That's not between you and the other person. So I think we're really misinterpreting Paul when we think he's advocating deal with the conflict before the sun goes down. That would be horrible advice in many situations if that's what Paul was trying to say.
In fact, isn't it in Psalm 4 where that same theme is applied, though, but just a different, but it says, I forget how it goes, wait until you've cooled off or something to the effect there?
Yeah, exactly. There's something, Neil, we call emotional contagion. Let's say I'm really angry at you, but I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to ignore Neil when I see him at work, or I'm not going to say anything mean, but on the other hand, I'm not going to be really kind towards him. Studies show that my emotions actually bleed onto you. We call that getting a negative vibe from a person. So your antennas are up. Anytime I walk in the room, you just sort of kind of pick up that, boy, something's with Tim. I just feel like he's mad at me. And so we've got to deal with the anger as much as possible and those emotions, the negative ones, because latent conflict never stays buried. That conflict does work its way to the surface, and it literally bleeds onto other individuals. And so we've got to deal with this issue, but the first step is to deal with that anger issue.
Along with that, then conversations comes needing forgiveness, and that's Jane's question. She's on line one. Jane, thanks. You're on with Tim Muehlhoff. Go ahead, your question.
Yeah, thank you for the program and all this great information. My question is in seeking forgiveness, because there seems to be some hindrances in my relationship about being too general about the offense and then not really accepting responsibility for the consequences and like turning around. When something is done, they turn around and blame you when they've actually committed the offense. How do you handle that? Are there steps to seeking forgiveness in the right way?
Well, this is a tough issue. But let's be careful not to confuse forgiveness with reconciliation. So forgiveness is a heart attitude that you have towards another person. And it can only take one person to forgive. Like, you might have to forgive your father or forgive a sister or forgive a coworker. And I think initially that can be just you forgiving the other person without that person getting involved. And the hard thing about the New Testament, Paul absolutely says to the church at Colossae in Colossians, I want you to forgive as Christ has forgiven you. So I do think the first step I have to take is, am I willing to forgive this person? Am I even willing to do that? Now, the second part is reconciliation, and it takes two people to reconcile. So if you go to that person and you say, listen, I was really hurt when you did this. Now, the other person might say, I didn't do that, or you're being way too sensitive, or I don't agree with your second order interpretation of what I did. Well, at that point, I think it's fair to once again explain your rationale, why you think this was an offense and why that person owes you an apology. But I think the Lord is eventually going to say to you, but if that never comes, a recognition of what that person has done, we still need to seek to forgive that person in our own heart. And to be honest, that's the issue I had with my dad for years, is my dad never apologized for certain things that I thought he did that he should apologize. So then I'm stuck. Do I just keep this bad attitude towards my dad, or do I eventually forgive him because the Lord has forgiven me of everything? And it took me years to wrestle with that. But let's not confuse forgiveness with reconciliation.
Tim Muehlhoff is my guest. Tim, among other things, is a professor of communication at Biola University. And he and his wife are frequent speakers at Family Life Marriage Conferences. He's served at the Campus Crusade since 1986 and written several books on communication. The God Conversation, co-authored The God Conversation, Using Stories and Illustrations to Explain Your Faith, and Authentic Communication, Christian Speech, Engaging Culture. We talked to him, I think, last time about his book, Marriage Forecasting, Changing the Climate in Your Relationship, One Conversation at a Time. His latest is expanding that a little bit to talk about how we can, in today's contentious, disagreeable world, how do we move from contentious debate to constructive dialogue, and how we can disagree without being disagreeable. It's called I Beg to Differ, Navigating Difficult Conversations with Truth and Love. And Tim is our guest today, and we've got some copies of his book to give away and welcome your question as well. If you'd like to just sign up to be in the drawing for the book, welcome to give us a call as well, 877-933-2484. It's 877-933-2484. Or you can drop us a note, go on email by going to our website, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. And we'll get your question in the studio right away and handle it here in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Give a gift. Change a life. It really is that simple. Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Your ongoing monthly support keeps Faith Radio on the air and growing. Every day, listeners are impacted, changed, and helped because of the relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching that your support provides. Won't you join us Tuesday, April 8th for our spring pledge drive known as Share? Your help is needed and appreciated. Thank you, and God bless you.
What does it mean that Jesus is the truth? Here's Nancy Lee DeMoss.
Your attitude toward truth will be exactly the same as your attitude toward Jesus. Because truth and Jesus are inseparable. Your attitude toward one reveals your attitude toward the other.
Jesus as the truth on the next Revive Our Hearts with Nancy Lee DeMoss.
Tune in weekday afternoons at 1:30 on Faith Radio.
Jesus in disguise.
It's 47 past the hour. Talking today with Tim Muehlhoff. Tim's professor of communication at Biola University and has written a new book called I Beg to Differ, Navigating Difficult Conversations with Truth and Love. And, you know, sometimes we wonder, can we find ways to agree with those that have differing views on, you know, whether it's conflicts politically or morally or whatever it might be, or just even within our own home and family? Getting some great insight on how to do that in the new book, I Beg to Differ. And Tim, we touched on here in the earlier section of the show just those four questions to ask, and I thought maybe just take a minute to review those. And then the other question, I guess, is do they have to be done in order? What happens if they're not done in order, or do we typically move to one before the other?
Yeah, they need to be done, I think, in order because they build upon each other. And before we get into the questions, let me just say to your listeners that the very end of the book, I actually put the strategy in action, and I created these dialogues. One has to do with a married couple disagreeing about finances. One has to do with a Christian wanting to share his faith with a Muslim coworker. And then the last one is a single mother wanting to confront her son about his overuse of social media. So there's real life application to this at the end of the book. But yeah, I think the questions need to be done in order because you're setting a tone to the entire conversation. So the first question is, what does this person believe? And we might think we already know that. I know what you believe about finances. I know what you believe about this work-related issue. But it affirms a person when you allow them, him or her, to say what they believe. And so the first question is very important. What does this person believe? The second question is, okay, why do you believe this? And the Harvard Negotiation Project says the biggest mistake we make is we only trade conclusions, not how we arrived at the conclusion. So I need to get the backstory of why this is so important to you, this particular issue. I mean, what influential people have impacted you? What life experiences brought you to the present moment? And then the third question is, okay, having just listened to all that, I'm going to ask myself the question, okay, where do I agree with what this person just said? And I would say it's got to be very rare that you listen to a person and can't find any points of agreement whatsoever. And then the fourth question is, with this person at this time, under these circumstances, what is one thing I should say to this person right now in the conversation?
You know, going back to, as you talked about those scenarios of kind of guided conversation, is it something where it would actually be helpful as an exercise, even as some of our callers have said, to have maybe work through the conversation or try and anticipate that, or at least think about how you're going to respond or what you're going to say?
Yeah. Oh, exactly, Neil. There's a proverb that says, the righteous weighs his answer. So that word weighs means to consider what your answer will be. So I think it's great to sit down and think about how this conversation could progress. I mean, there's no other area of life that we just jump in. Like if we're going to do a diet, it's better to have a plan of what that diet is going to look like. If we jump into an exercise program, it's best to know ahead of time what that exercise program is going to be like and what some of the hindrances might be. So I think it's fine to think through the conversation so long as you're not painting the other person as this angry, irrational person. If every time you work through the conversation in your mind, the other person is acting hateful or spiteful, then that actually could do great damage. We want to try to be as charitable as possible to a person and have a full picture of our boss, or coworker. If I look at my boss and I can't think of one positive thing to say about this person, then I think my perception might be skewed rather than that person.
You know, there's in your book, I beg to differ, you bring up the principle of indebtedness. Talk about why that's so key. That was fascinating to me.
Yeah, we call it the rule of reciprocation, which means, generally speaking, how I treat you, you'll feel indebted to treat me the same way. So let me give you a for instance. My wife and I lived in Moscow for a year, and there was a woman who ran the hotel that we lived at that just didn't like us. She didn't like Americans. And so we'd be 1 minute late to dinner, and she would close the door, and we wouldn't get dinner that night. Well, one day, a bunch of us are going to play basketball, and there's a Russian car stuck in the snow, and there's an elderly man trying to push it with a woman in the front seat. So we just walk over. I mean, Neil, these Russian cars, think of an American smart car and cut it in half. I mean, these are really small cars. So we walked over there, lifted it up. They literally got out of the place where they were stuck. This woman who owns the hotel comes out of the driver's seat. And we thought she was going to yell at us. But the next day, we come down for breakfast, she has flowers for us. We could be late to dinner an hour, and she'd come in her bathrobe and make us dinner. Why? She felt indebted towards us. So when we're kind to people, so Peter says, I want you to bless a person when you feel insulted. If we do that to a person, I think generally speaking, that person is going to feel indebted. So if we take time to listen and find common ground, I think a person will feel indebted to return that to us during the course of a conversation.
So could this actually, these principles infiltrate a society? I mean, can this be more than salt and light if we actually, Christians, started practicing this?
Well, Neil, it's already happened. We have historical proof. If you want to know why the early church grew like it did, two massive plagues hit the Roman Empire. We're talking mortality rates of roughly 30-35%. People did not know what to do with these two great plagues. But Christians, so if a family member got sick in your household, you didn't know what to do. You took that family member and you stuck them outside so the rest of the family wouldn't get sick. Well, Christians came out into the streets, grabbed these individuals, took them back home, fed them, bathed them, and a lot of those people survived and felt this incredible indebtedness towards Christians. Even if they didn't believe in the Christian doctrine, they knew these were good people, and I need to return that kindness. So one of the huge reasons the church grew like it did is what Paul would say: when your enemy is hungry, feed him. When he's thirsty, give him something to drink. And so that indebtedness absolutely got played out historically, and I think it can happen again in American culture, is that we help the people we disagree with, even though we might have philosophical or political disagreements, we still help each other as Americans who care for each other.
You know, it does seem like this takes a little forethought, and I wonder if that's maybe one of the challenges where we're not particularly trained in these areas, are we? I mean, we all learn how to speak by, 1 year old, but that doesn't necessarily mean we know how to communicate.
Well, this is where, you know, the subtitle of the book, Neil, is Navigating Difficult Conversations in Truth and Love, based on what the Apostle Paul says, speak the truth in love. And so there's always two parts of communication. It's my content, which could be my argument, my facts, and all that kind of stuff. But the second part of communication is what we call the relational level, and that is the amount of love and respect between two individuals. And today, I think we are just truth speakers, and we've totally forgotten about the love part. And if you mess up the love part, it does not matter what you say content-wise. So even Peter says this, right? He says, I want you to be ready to defend your faith, but to do it with gentleness and respect. So I think today in American culture, we've lost the gentleness and respect and love parts, and we just say, hey, I'm going to present the truth as I see it, and I'm going to ram it down your throat. And I think that has filtered down into our schools, our communities, and our marriages, and we need to reclaim a biblical view of communication, which is speaking truth and love.
You were in the book, you give an example of some parents inviting you to talk to their son who had sort of walked away from the faith. And you know, it was interesting, just as you got to discover kind of why he was believing that, I mean, you learned a lot more about him, which probably we need to do a lot more in our dialogue and discussion.
Yeah, so for your listeners to understand what we're talking about, there was a man who was walking away from the faith when I was doing grad school, and his Christian parents called me and begged me to meet with them. So this guy finally agreed to meet with me. Now listen, heading into this conversation, he knows what's going on. I'm the person handpicked by his parents to talk him out of walking away from Christianity. So you could have cut the tension with a knife when we first sat down. And I simply said to him, listen, Mark, just tell me what's going on. I mean, what do you believe now? And he told me what he believed, that Jesus wasn't God, the Bible wasn't inspired. And then instead of jumping in and saying, oh, I've got a response to each one of those, I forced myself. The book of Proverbs says a wise man overlooks an insult. So I forced myself to say, hey, what's happened? You grew up in a Christian home, so like, what happened? And that's when he talked about a deeply revered faculty member in grad school who finally embraced Mark because Mark was moving away from the Bible. And that's why this faculty member now is embracing him. So, again, I could have launched into my debate. You know, these are apologetic issues I've studied before. But I didn't. I forced myself to say I need to get the backstory as much as possible, what's happening in Mark's life. And then I even affirmed him, question three. I affirmed him. I said, Mark, there's nothing wrong with questioning your faith. There's nothing wrong with thinking about things, but I just want you to do it in a way that's fair to both Christianity and the perspective your professor is giving you.
And then not sort of dumping the truck in terms of there's one thing to say or to do or to respond.
Yeah, and so, Neil, as I'm listening to Mark, he was pretty defensive because he knew I was handpicked. He knew I was on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ. So for me to launch into exactly what he was thinking, that I would try to talk him out of it this first lunch, I just thought to myself, no, the one thing I need to say to Mark is, I would like to continue this conversation with you. And we did. We met for an entire semester, and it reminded me of a Longfellow quote that said, if we knew the secret history of our enemies, it would produce compassion.
Good spot to wrap up our conversation. We're out of time with Tim Muehlhoff, who's a professor of communication at Biola University and the author of the new book called I Beg to Differ. You can find the podcast of our conversation online at myfaithradio.com.